The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Blackpool, Liverpool. This time it's Gerrard's teammates that have problems with the DJ as tangerines prove banana skins all over again. Next up for King Kenny, the derby. Meantime, Carling Cup ahoy. Ipswich on, Gunners switch off as Tractor Boys furrow brows at Arsenal. While in other clash, Birmingham let down by lack of foster care as Avram Grant looks set to have more than just a semi once again. The midweek action reviewed, plus the word from Scotland, Spain, Post, and a preview of a very meaty Premier League weekend. Derbies in Birmingham, London, Newcastle and Liverpool. Plus, Spurs, Man United. Could this be where the unbeaten run ends? All of that in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. Very, very, very busy pod today. We've got five people in here. So oxygen very much at a premium. David Conn, hello.
Hello there.
A rare physical appearance in the, you know.
Well, it was an offer that I really couldn't turn down.
Right,
I was here, and it's a great pleasure to be here, seriously.
Oh, lovely. You're going to be talking to us about all sorts of things that are interesting, but I couldn't quite get the will to read through in an article later on, like the UEFA Platini business. And
that's
like that.
Usually what I have to do.
Excellent.
Talk about things that people struggle to read through, yes. Yes.
Okay, excellent. Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi, Paul. You're going to do all sorts of things, no doubt.
I'll talk about whatever you ask me about before
Brilliant.
Cutting me off.
All right, good. As if. John Ashton.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hello.
Good. And Sean Ingle.
Hello.
Hi, Sean. You're looking bright and chipper.
I try.
Good. You're probably still excited from all the delights of Bloomfield Road on Wednesday night. Blackpool with a 2-1 win again over Liverpool, putting those crazy tangerines back into the top half.
And you've got to give, you know, every bit of credit to them. I mean, I was looking at the stats yesterday, and Blackpool had only played one of the top 10 teams at home. So you thought, well, might it be a time, you know, with people linking Charlie Adam away from the club, with people talking about maybe David Vaughan going, you perhaps wondered whether there might be some uncertainty at Blackpool. But they thoroughly deserved their win, and they're doing fantastically.
Is Charlie Adam leaving?
Well, I think if a club bigs enough money for them, I think he will go.
They've turned down two offers so far, haven't they?
Well, Villa and Liverpool have supposedly been in from.
It'd be a good signing for someone. And so would Ian Holloway. I think he's certainly got to have impressed a lot of chairmen at even bigger clubs. I mean, much as I'd love to see him stay at Blackburn and continue that... and continue their rise and perhaps consolidate them as a force. It'd be brilliant to see what he can do with even more resources and even better players. I mean, perhaps Liverpool could do with him.
I don't want to patronise Holloway, but I obviously had to leap in and cut you off there.
Yeah.
but is what he's done at Blackpool, is that recreatable at a bigger club? Is it something to do with the unique atmosphere, the low pressure at a...
Well, I don't know, and there's only one way to find out, really, isn't there? But, I mean, the Moneyball men at Liverpool, for example, have to be impressed by his transfer dealings. He's brought guys from lower league for very little money, guys who in some cases weren't even getting into their teams at the lower league, and he's turned them into a premiership force. And of course, they play a wonderful, exciting, attractive football, the like of which Liverpool, for example, haven't seen for a while.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's very hard. We sort of touched on it the other day. It's hard to know how managers will adapt to their new surroundings and if something that's worked in one place is going to work somewhere else. I mean, Holloway had more money probably when he was at QPR. Never got the team playing anything like the way that he's got Blackpool playing. And the same's true at Leicester. And he'd had that success at Plymouth and at Bristol Rovers before that. And you do wonder, I mean, there's definitely no guarantee that that works somewhere else.
But he showed his adaptability and his ability to learn from mistakes, because, I mean, he says it himself, he totally reviewed the way he approached management, and Blackpool are now yielding the benefit from that.
Hmm. Meantime, people pointing out that if Hodgson had put out a side which included Christian Poulsen, Milan Jovanovic and Glenn Johnson at left back, and waited until they were a goal down with 40 minutes to go before making a first change, he'd probably have been crucified.
I couldn't agree more about Blackpool and the way that they play and the contrast between the way they play and how together they are and how, as Paul was saying, the players have come from smaller clubs and they're just having a right go and they're playing as an old-fashioned, let's get stuck in, let's roll our sleeves up and let's play. With Holloway seeming to me like the perfect manager for them, really. And for me, it's a big factor that he's come from the Championship up and they've still got that momentum. And I'm not sure about if he made the move to definitely a club like Liverpool where there's a big rebuilding job to do. But the contrast between the way that they're playing as a team like that and as a unit and Liverpool, who used to be the ultimate unit but at the highest possible level, just falling apart, having no team togetherness whatsoever. And I thought that the appointment of Dalglish, it just looks, you know, if someone, however much of a legend he is, if he hasn't managed for 20 years...
He's managed for 20 years. His last job was 2000 at Celtic and before that in the Premier League.
Right, so he hasn't managed at all for 10 and he hasn't managed at Liverpool for 20. Mm. He's been out of actually managing for all that time. To come in and think that he can turn them around because of the man that he is. And Alan Hansen at the weekend saying, oh, he'll give them a right rocket in the dressing room and that's what's going to make the difference. I think that this, playing against a team that's as drilled as Ian Holloway's Blackpool is, exposes really, you know, the job that he's genuinely got rather than just being able to come in, be the big icon and give them a rocket.
Yeah. They've now lost more points from winning positions than any other team in the league this season, which shows what a lack of resolve there is at the club.
Oh, winning positions, because of course Torres had given an early glimmer of hope that there was some magical Dalglish effect with that goal after 3 minutes. Sean?
That's right, it's a very, very quick point. I think it's a very important transfer window for Blackpool. They need to keep hold of their big players. Case in point, two seasons ago, Hull had 27 points after 20 games, nearly went down after going in freefall. Blackpool have 28 points in a similar position. I think they should stay up, but you know, you would want to keep hold of their best two or three players, obviously.
They have the derby up next. Blackpool will be at West Brom this weekend, while Liverpool, it's almost like a kind of Dalglish starting off with a greatest hits run of Hodgson's biggest defeats. You've got the Blackpool, then you have Everton, and then Wolves to follow. All three of them without Steven Gerrard. Of course, but no Cahill for Everton this time. Everton completely in control in the first game at Goodison. What are our thoughts on this one?
Well, as a better, 9 of the last 10 games have finished under 2.5 goals, and you think with no Cahill, Liverpool misfiring might be worth looking at.
Would anyone here put money on Liverpool for this game?
I wouldn't, but it's worth pointing out that they have won 5 of their last 6 league matches at home. They're the second best.
Who, Liverpool?
They're the second best in the form table behind Manchester United in the home record. So you shouldn't be so dismissive.
So that was under Roy Hodgson?
Yeah.
Fair point. Mm. And also on that theme, Everton haven't won at Anfield since 1999.
We can trace that. Interestingly, Barney Ronay was tweeting last night about how maybe Liverpool should get rid of Dalglish. He's taken the club as far as he can. And it got trended on Twitter, so it was one of the sort of top things. He's very excited about it. He phoned me up this morning. He's going to write a comment about it on Saturday.
Yeah, oh, when you go to the homepage of Twitter, it's got like five things. Usually something from...
Justin Bieber.
Exactly, yeah.
But Barney was there next, to the Bieber.
In the Carling Cup, meanwhile, we had West Ham with their 2-1 victory over Birmingham. And what's the situation there then, Paul? Because they've not done badly. In 7 matches, they've only lost once, Avram Grant, despite the many problems. And even so, he seems to be still next in line for the big chopper. He's been given one more week, I believe. Is that right? You got another week.
It's almost like the owners are waiting for an excuse to sack him. They're disappointed every time he gets a good result. Obviously, I don't know whether that is the case. Yeah, it was kind of West Ham's season in microcosm, except for the fact that they did end up winning the match the other night. But it was a real helter-skelter performance where they mixed some quite decent and spirited play with some just knocking off, basically, for half an hour, 40 minutes, and not doing anything and allowing Birmingham back into it. And Birmingham are a terrible team, so you shouldn't really allow yourself to be dominated by them. And I think that they'll probably reach the final now, which would extend a fine run of Grant of getting to a final every season and getting sacked.
That's true,
and also possibly getting a team relegated as well. I mean, I think the problem is at West Ham is that there are several members of the board that want him to go, and there's a couple that want to give him a little bit more time, hence this impasse. But the way things are, you can't really see a happy finish for him because...
Sean Ingle, for goodness sake. Is the problem also not that the people that they had lined up or inked in to possibly take over are less than enthusiastic about joining Golden Sullivan?
Well, that's the point I was going to come to make until you interrupted me.
People complain all the time about foreign owners.
Right.
Some of the English owners in the Premier League, I wouldn't like to work for them, apart from the generous salary I'd get. Well, for the likes of Mike Ashley and Golden Sullivan and Peter Ridsdale from the past, I'm not sure that they're necessarily better than your nasty foreign owners.
That was it. When all the foreign owners were coming in and people were saying the problem is foreign owners, Mike Ashley took over Newcastle just to make the counter argument, didn't he?
West Ham have their own little derby going on this weekend. They're up against Arsenal, home to Arsenal. Arsenal, conveniently enough, were also in action in the Cup. In the Carling Cup semi-finals, losing 1-0 to Ipswich. Sean Ingle, tell us all about it.
Arsenal thoroughly deserves to lose. Ipswich were great. They sort of adopted that template of playing 4-5-1, keeping it tight, looking to hit Arsenal on the break. And every time they did attack, Arsenal's defence looked really ropey. I mean, Thomas Priskan, who scored the winner, had a couple of other chances to score, a couple of one-on-ones. And Arsenal just looked... I don't know, they look strangely lethargic.
Not bothered, do you think?
No, of course they're bothered. It's a kind of cup semi-final, but I don't know, you looked at kind of the energy of someone like Conor Wickham, who was charging down the flanks, and you kind of compared that with, I don't know, with Danielson, who had nothing, who had a buoy, who had a poor game, Bendtner, who talks so much, and he's like the Audie Harrison of football. You know, he gives it the big I am, and then doesn't do enough on the pitch. And I thought Ipswich were great. But against a team that had lost 7-0 on Sunday, go in and hit them hard. Mm-hmm. You don't pussyfoot around. You hit them hard, knock them out, and then watch them tumble.
The second leg of that tie now is probably Arsenal's big, most important game of the season now. Because Wenger has been saying all season that all this team lacks is it has to pop its trophy cherry and deliver when it really matters. And once they get overcome that mental hurdle, then they're going to be a great team forevermore. And obviously, in the first leg, they utterly failed to perform.
Right. They still have the FA Cup, of course, the replay at Elland Road against
Leeds. They do, but the League Cup is there for the taking, really. I mean, they should, if they perform to the best of their ability, they should dispose of Ipswich and win the final against whoever they play against. They're not going to get a better chance to win a trophy anytime soon. And they've failed to rise to the challenge so far.
He made a specific point of saying that he was going to take the Carling Cup seriously because they needed to win a trophy. But I'm not sure that he used the phrase "pop our trophy cherry," but he definitely said they needed to win something.
But I really, really hope that Ipswich get through, because I just think it, although okay, maybe down the line it will matter for Arsenal, I'm not sure, but I think that I think Arsenal fans aren't going to be that bothered about winning the Carling Cup. Maybe it's important for grand scheme of things, it's a small thing for them. Whereas for Ipswich, I mean, they've not been to Wembley since 2000, and it'd just be it's a big thing for smaller clubs to get to Wembley and play in those showpiece finals, and for Arsenal fans, I don't think it really matters.
I was going to say about the manager because the running theme of some of these teams is the managerial change, and Liverpool changed the manager to have an inspirational figure from the past, and I take your point, it's his first league game, but he hasn't had that immediate impact. Whereas for Ipswich, perhaps the relief of no longer being managed by Roy Keane, and suddenly they're, as you say, turbocharged. I mean, there's definitely, obviously, the manager, like with Ian Holloway, he's built a team, he's spotted the players, as you said before, he's taken his time over it, he's learnt his lesson in the past. It's a long-term, or it's been a medium-term project. But there is that immediate impact of the new manager, which the Avram Grant problem is that the managers get sacked in the Premier League if the owners think there is any chance of them being relegated, because they're going to lose 40 million a year or whatever. You know, they cannot risk being relegated, and that's when Blackburn famously sacked Paul Ince, which seemed unduly ruthless for the Blackburn tradition, and got Sam Allardyce, who didn't seem right for the Blackburn tradition, but they couldn't risk being relegated. So they're in that trouble. But that immediate impact of Roy Keane going and suddenly they're beating Arsenal, I think is interesting, as well as poor old Dalgleish, you know, seeing the reality of things at Bloomfield Road.
The immediate impact to Roy Keane going was losing 7-0 at Chelsea.
Yeah, you've just destroyed my theory, and I talked for a very long time.
What a way to bounce back, though. What character to bounce back from that. And indeed, Zonal Marking tweeting saying that the win against Arsenal. It was why Man City should have had some level of attacking threat when they played Arsenal this time last week. West Ham, anyway, facing Arsenal this weekend. Am I right in saying that Arsenal have only won two of their last seven games? Is that right?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. They've won four of the last six away, haven't they?
They're
a decent away side.
Yeah, they lost vital points at Upton Park last year in a 2-2 draw when it was kind of classic Arsenal performance. Dominated the game, never really finished it off. Sami Nasri, of course, should be back for that clash after being rested for the two cup fixtures. So that's it for a rip-roaring part one. In part two, we'll be casting our pod net a little bit wider, catching little fishies from FIFA and the SPL and that kind of thing.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
Ooh, I see we're Skyping, aren't we? Couple of quick posts. DB88 says, Lionel Messi scored the most goals, made the most assists, completed the most dribbles in the Liga in 2010. No doubt he was the right choice to win the Ballon d'Or, brought to you by FIFA. He's on another level. Toon Toon, though, presents the counter-argument. The league table for La Liga is enough proof that the league is massively bust towards the top two, so it's hardly surprising that an already excellent player is having a field day over there. Whereas he flopped relatively in the Champions League later stages and in the World Cup, this is beyond dispute. Two sides of a debate that has been raging across the continent this week. Should Messi have won the Ballon d'Or? To tell us more about that and, I hope, much more, because frankly it's a bit dull, is Sid Lowe on the line from Madrid. Sid, are you there?
Hello, James. I'm here. I'm going to, frankly, a bit dull you, shall I? Is that what we're after? It's a bizarre one, this, and it's been really, really bitter, the response to this in certain parts of Spain. And I must admit, I don't quite understand why people are so full of hatred over it, or appear to be.
I don't know. I should just warn listeners that this is virtual Sid. This is Skype Sid today.
And rough, not smooth, not rough.
Smooth, not rough, yeah. So anyway, dull away then, Sid.
Well, I mean, the reaction, I mean, first of all, it depends on your criteria. And obviously, when you're looking at a situation in which 427 voters, then of course the criteria is going to be slightly different from one to the other. The fact that some people will argue it's a disgrace that Messi's got it and others will say it's absolutely right that he's got it. Well, surely in a way, that's just a reflection of the kind of things that are going through the heads of the people who vote. When I say that the reaction has been bizarre, it's been bizarre and angry and really a bit exaggerated on lots of different levels. One of them is the most important reaction, I suppose, from the Spanish point of view. And I don't really want to express this as being something that all of the Spanish are indulging in, because of course they're not. But the Spain's best-selling newspaper Marca ran with a story that said Sepp Blatter is anti-Spanish, and on the front cover it had a picture of the two guys that won the awards, obviously Jose Mourinho, who was the Ballon d'Or coach of the year, and bizarrely enough no one really complained about that in Madrid, despite the fact he beat two Spanish coaches to it, and the other one was Messi. So the headline said two geniuses and one anti-Spaniard, with a little picture of Blatter. Then it had the masthead of the newspaper Marca's Marca's name in red and gold, obviously Spain's colours, with the World Cup winning star above it. And in brackets alongside it said, these are the colours that Blatter detests. Well, I'm not sure that it's fair to say that Spain have been let off or that anyone's been anti-Spanish. Blatter, for a start, doesn't vote. 427 other people do. Spain had 2 and 3 on the podium. 7 Spaniards were voted for as first place by one person or another. That's the most a country's ever had. 42% of the vote went to Spaniards. Of the 3 men on the podium, all 3 play for Spanish clubs. Schneider wasn't there. 8 of the 11 in the team of the year play for Spanish clubs. So the notion of anti-Spanish, I just think, is absolutely laughable.
And Mark Van Bommel couldn't even obey the rules in the vote.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
He voted for Dutch players. You're not allowed to vote for people from your own country.
And the Argentinians didn't get the votes in time either. That's the other one.
Did they not?
That's why there's no votes from Argentina.
Oh, okay. Copa del Rey, in the meantime, plenty of action. A 5-0 Barcelona win with Leo Messi just underlining why so many voters reckon he's the best in the world, with another hat-trick. And what else?
Well, what else is we had an amazing Sevilla 3-3 last night. We've got the Madrid derby tonight, Real Madrid against Atletico Madrid.
Woof indeed.
And of course, everybody's waiting to see if Atletico Madrid can capitulate as usual.
And people are actually caring about the Copa del Rey this time around.
Yeah, it's. I think there's a couple of reasons for it. The first one is that in a league in which obviously most clubs now not only can't win the league, in fact every club apart from the big two not only can't win the league, but know they can't win the league. There's almost a Homer Simpson thing here: can't win, don't try. Whereas the Copa del Rey gives them half a hope, so I think teams are taking it perhaps that little bit more seriously than normal. The downside of that, from their point of view, is that Madrid and Barcelona are both taking it seriously as well. Madrid, I think, because they haven't won the Copa del Rey for goodness knows how long. I think I'm right in saying it's 17 years now. Jose Mourinho, as a new coach, wants to get some sort of success under his belt. I think Real Madrid recognise that this is an opportunity, and so they're taking it seriously. Because they're taking it seriously, Barcelona are almost obliged to do the same. So we are in a strange position where the Copa del Rey is really working. I actually think, and I'm normally a huge critic of the ridiculous way that Copa del Rey is handled by the Spanish Football Federation, but this idea of playing a whole raft of games in January, basically every midweek throughout January, actually seems to be working, because it's kind of focusing attention on the tournament in a way that didn't happen before. And in fact, the reverse, of course, of what UEFA have done by splitting up some of the Champions League rounds, which I think doesn't work, but they seem to think it does.
Finally, Sid, Smith17, a particularly perplexing post here, saying anyone watching Barca Betis in the Cup will have seen Pinto, aka hip-hop producer Joaquin Maquinaciones, in goal for Barca de Oro. What's this about?
In goal for Barca de Oro? Pinto, the Barcelona substitute goalkeeper, is a big hip-hop fan, has very silly hair quite a lot of the time,
right.
And yeah, has a recording studio. He's from down somewhere near Cadiz. I think he might be from Puerto de Santa Maria, which is the same place that Joaquin Sanchez is from.
Right.
And yeah, he's very much a kind of hip-hop music-y fan.
All right, and he actually produces his own records and
music
stuff
as well. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, cool.
Not quite as cool as Royce and Drenthe, but nearly.
Or Andy Cole, indeed.
Andrew, please.
Andrew Cole. Many thanks, and look forward to speaking to you on Monday.
Okay, brilliant. Speak to you then.
Thank you, Sid.
Thank you. Cheerio.
Sid there on the line from Madrid. Clearer and also cheaper, because we don't have to pay for that call. All right, then.
Portsmouth's Greg Halford also has a record label as well.
Does he?
He once celebrated a goal by taking off his shirt, revealing advertising for his record label underneath.
All right, okay.
Classy celebration.
What kind of music does he have on it?
I've no idea, actually. I haven't heard any of his stuff, any of his acts.
Right, okay. Rio Ferdinand also has a recording label, I believe, doesn't he? As well as a magazine and just about everything else.
And Marcus Hanneman's a big, big heavy metal fan, isn't he? Really sort of the extreme, the more extreme, the better, I think.
Okay. He also looks like the lead singer from Limp Bizkit and gets very...
Fred Durst?
Yeah, and he gets upset if you say that to him.
Right, as indeed any right-thinking person would. Fred Durst. Okay, good. UEFA, David, you've been writing loads of notes while Sid was talking. What were your notes on?
They weren't about all the 472 votes in the Ballon d'Or, but no. I just suddenly started to think, he's going to turn to me next and go, UEFA, that thing about finances that I couldn't get through, please can you explain it
all?
So I was sort of being the swat in the room again and making some last-minute notes.
All right.
And what I've decided with my last-minute thoughts is the thing to stress here. We've got huge debts because the clubs don't manage their books, and that's what UEFA's financial fair play plan is all about. And our 20 Premier League clubs in 2009, the year 2009, had debts of up to about £3 billion. I think what happened this week was UEFA saying, this is coming in. It's coming in from next season now.
Mm.
The debate about should it be coming in, is it a good idea that clubs should balance their books across Europe, that has been had, and everybody has voted in favour of this plan, including the professional leagues and professional clubs. And it is coming in, and the clubs are going to have to restrain their spending and live within their means. And that was the point of this week. And actually, I think it's really interesting how this rule has gone from being something obscure that's obviously been in the back of people's minds, I think including Man City, to becoming something that they can suddenly see right in front of them as going to change their behaviour. So what people expect is that, well, if the seven or eight clubs that are in the Champions League and Europa League down the Premier League having to comply, ultimately the Premier League will introduce it for everyone, and that it will trickle down the league here and in Europe. And so if you then, what UEFA, when they've explained it to me, I've been over there talking to them, and they make sense, and they say, we actually want, if we're going to have, this is one of their arguments that doesn't get through, if we're going to have people buying football clubs, we want them to be decent people and we want them to be straight people and we'd like them to be people with money and a bit of a plan. But if the game is a complete free-for-all with clubs going bust and every club making a loss, we're not attracting the kind of responsible people into it. And they're looking to a kind of sane financial European football and hoping that we get there. And then after that, I think that it would be great to have an argument about making it a more level playing field with the smaller clubs.
Fascinating stuff. We shall see. We shall see. In the meantime, suppose Jesse Plainmore, among the many people enjoying Greg Ruffley's reminiscences of his happy youth spent at Ewood Park, top podding, and she asked, does Greg, I think it's a she, Jesse, might not be, she, anyway, they ask, does Greg answer the phone with Ruffley speaking? Interesting question. Tommy87 says the FA Cup roundup in Monday's pod was exceptionally disappointed and lists a lot of reasons why. Fair cop on all of those. A lot of games to get through. Crawley happened after the pod, and they're the only remaining non-league team through, etc.
Yeah, and they've got a chance of making it into the fifth round. I think they've got Torquay, I haven't mentioned them, Torquay away or Hereford away, something like that.
Hereford,
it's a, it's a winnable game for them.
In other post news, Up Your Arson says, will there be an Asian Cup roundup in the next pod? No, I think probably. Although, actually, Paul Doyle's just put his hand up. Paul?
No, I'm scratching. Oh, okay. Right. I haven't seen any of the Asian Cup. Not many people have. The attendances have been appalling.
Although it was quite full for Qatar's victory over China, which Ars Technica was saying, did anybody see the Qataris? Cracking goals from Yusuf Ahmed. Indeed, they were fine. Actually, and the stadium was quite full. Although apparently, for the Qatar's game with the United Arab Emirates, there are only 3,000 there. Which is a bit disappointing. The other big game, of course, being Iran's come-from-behind victory over Iraq. So there you go. Celtic Berico says, I have to say I'm a little surprised that the story of bullets being sent to 9/11 and Niall McGinn, isn't deemed newsworthy in a roundup of football this week, but a Villarreal player kicking a bottle is. Yeah. Well, it is a bizarre, very troubling story, that one, with the bullets, because a third player has now received, or there was a package with bullets destined for a third player, intercepted at the post office. Ewan Murray, now Jones is on the line, to tell us a bit more. Ewan.
James, how are you?
Hi, I'm ever so well, Ewan. As usual, we've got you on to talk about the brighter side of football.
I'm starting to take it personally.
Yeah, sorry about that. Can you explain, can you fill in any of the details on this extraordinary case?
Pretty much as you explained, James. I mean, I am slightly wary that when things like this come to light, and it's perfectly correct that they come to light, but I think people think they happen all the time where the old firm are involved, and thankfully they don't. But it is a timely reminder to the madness which surrounds people at Rangers and Celtic, let's be honest, because they can be subject to some pretty horrible stuff. And, you know, Neil Lennon, probably sad to say, but Neil Lennon has become slightly immune to things like this. But there's two young players, Paddy McCourt and Niall McGinn, who have caused no trouble at all to anyone, as far as I'm aware, during their time in Glasgow. And for them to be subjected to something like this is pretty sad.
What is the prevalent theory about where the bullets are coming from?
Well, the prevalent theory is they came from Northern Ireland, which is where the first two packages were intercepted. The third one made it to Glasgow. But the current theory certainly is, and the police are investigating it, that they all did emanate from the same place.
All right. OK. Ewan, there's been one or two other bits of SPL news since last we spoke. Well, probably plenty, actually, but one that's been dominating headlines in the last week or two has been the proposed move to a 10-team SPL, much the chagrin of supporters everywhere, really.
Much the chagrin of everyone, yeah. Supporters, journalists, certain clubs. James, the baffling thing is that people seem to genuinely believe that changing the size of the league will be a cure-all for Scottish football. The blunt truth is it doesn't matter if the SPL's two teams or 52 teams, that the product within that league just now isn't good enough. And we now have a pretty unseemly situation where clubs are arguing amongst themselves of whether it should be a 10-team league, a 12-team league, a 14-team league. And there's a meeting on Monday at which the SPL had hoped there would be a vote to ratify a move to 10 teams, but that's pretty unlikely as things stand just now.
All right. When would this 10-team league come in from?
The start of season 2012-13.
All right.
I mean, there are other things built into the proposals which make sense, that a winter break, for example, an earlier start to the season. Clubs in general fully support that, and that's not a problem. But the actual size of the league, and we're, you know, we'd be talking here about 10 teams just playing each other four times, that, I'm afraid, doesn't capture the imagination of many people at all.
Lohan Hawitsi, or something similar, says, a tiny word, if you could, on Aberdeen FC's revival under Craig Brown would be appreciated.
Very pertinent point. Craig Brown's done a terrific job after doing a great job at Motherwell. He has moved up there. You know, Craig Brown is now 86, remember? He's got a move to Aberdeen and really revived them after a disastrous time under Mark McGee. And given Rangers have drawn Celtic in the Scottish Cup, that tournament has opened up for someone else. They're already in the semi-finals of a League Cup, so I wouldn't bet against Craig Brown leading Aberdeen to some silverware this season even.
Did you say Craig Brown is now 86?
Yeah, that was a joke. It maybe didn't work.
Oh, right, sorry. I actually took you seriously. Sorry. Excellent. All right, well, magnificent stuff, Ewan. And, well, as that competition progresses, then let's catch up with you again.
Excellent. Speak to you soon.
That's it for part two. Part three awaits, in which we tackle a big weekend in the Premier League. Chelsea, first of all, are taking on Blackburn, the team that cost Roy Hodgson his job in the last round of games. Chelsea, with only one win in nine matches, but they have had that 7-0 win over Ipswich in the FA Cup. Paul Doyle, you're going to this game. Big boost to morale. Will it, does it represent anything else? The FA Cup win over Ipswich?
I don't know. I didn't see that, but I'm looking forward to seeing Chelsea in action.
Are you?
And I remain intrigued by John Michele Obi, who has failed to come to the fore this season, I think. Although he's actually touched the ball more than any other player in the Premier League this season.
Really?
Yeah. But I wonder how many of those touches have actually been relevant or progressive in any way. And Chelsea, it seems, have been basically carrying him for a long time. And when the people who had been carrying him were either lost form or were out injured, he wasn't able to drive the team forward by himself. So I'm particularly interested to see him this weekend.
All right. And a quick word about Steve Keane. Because Blackburn are only four places behind Chelsea now. They won't have Paul Robinson, but as I say, they've just had that victory over Liverpool. And
It's been fascinating, hasn't it, really? Because when he first took over, he looked like a rabbit caught in the headlights. Mm. He wasn't even second in command to Sam Allardyce. That was Neil McDonald, and he got effectively sacked, or he left at the same time. And Steve Keane is obviously a client of Jerome Anderson, the agent, who has been very much involved in those great words that you never thought you would see together in the English language, which is that Blackburn Rovers has been bought by an Indian chicken company. Mm. You know, we talked about foreign ownership before. I mean, that for me just sort of tells you that something can't quite be right. But so people thought Steve Keane, he's just a placeman, he's been put there, he's going to be a tool. But apparently Jerome Anderson has been saying for a long time that he's a great coach that just needs his chance. Of course, everyone was questioning that. And then they absolutely slaughtered Liverpool. And suddenly Steve Keane started to seem like he had a bit of a plan. He comes across quite well, quite considered, quite thoughtful. It's actually fascinating that they're doing quite well, because people thought as soon as the chicken company arrived, and as soon as, you know, they lost the first game, and Big Sam dragged them out of the relegation zone, and obviously did a competent, if quite pragmatic, job. And instead, as you say, they're really doing well and playing better football.
Yep, they've hatched a plan, haven't they, at Blackburn?
The puns are endless. It's been great writing about it. You know, saying if Jack Walker's trustees pluck out Venkis, and you know, and all the comments below your pieces are just full of exactly, and it's great.
Cracking stuff. All right, Man City, your lot are taking on Wolves. City lost against Wolves, of course, in October, 2-1, did they not?
Which was the start of the mini crisis, the mini Mancini City in crisis kind of, will they stick with him, wasn't it?
Was
losing to Wolves. And then he pulled it round, and they said, what sort of crisis are we in? We're in the top four and all that. They're strong at home, aren't they?
And worth pointing out, too, that if they do win on Saturday, they'll go top of the league for the first time since David probably had long hair and listened to, Joy Division.
long curly hair.
Okay. All right, then.
That would have been a sight.
You may feel the same about Stoke versus Bolton, as Bolton haven't won away in four games, but they did beat Stoke back at home earlier this season. West Brom, meantime, are taking on Blackpool, as we said. Wigan against Fulham, big game there at the bottom. John Ashton, the Birmingham Aston Villa game, is that one that lights your particular fire? David Bentley, is there any chance you might be playing in that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah?
They're always, those derbies, Birmingham Villa is feisty even as derbies go.
Yeah.
And it's a relegation battle this time around as well. Ooh. For the first time in a long time. So the pressure's really, really going to be on.
Oh.
Birmingham had a good result down at West Ham the other week. Oh, the things, I mean, they were terrible for the first half, Birmingham were, and then they turned it around, and although you sort of think West Ham maybe allowed them to turn it around. And Villa have been a bit stop-start under Houllier, one good result, one bad result. It could be quite an ugly spectacle, but it's an important one.
Isn't it more like one good result, four or five bad results?
Yeah. But I think it's guaranteed to be an ugly spectacle.
Well, the last three games in the league have been 0-1 goals, although the Colin Cup game earlier this season was quite exciting.
All right, David Bentley, how does he, because he's arriving now, is it on loan or have they actually bought him from Spurs?
On loan.
How does he fit into the old Birmingham setup? Is that tactically something that's an obvious match or not?
Yeah, presumably they'd play him on the right-hand side of midfield where Seb Larsson usually roams.
Right.
And I don't know, I don't think that there's a glaring gap in their team that Bentley's sort of there
and he fires
the
balls for what, Jerome or what?
Yeah, well, there's a Larsson takes all the set pieces as well, so... Right. They've replaced, well, I mean, if he does replace, I mean, maybe they'll shift Larsson into the centre, something like that.
Is this about getting the best out of Zigic? Is that what it is? I don't know. Mid question.
Larsson looks like he's going to go. And it's all about providing service to their front man, who, I mean, Birmingham have no creativity. Their set pieces is their only threat, and they don't even tend to win many set pieces. They've had fewer corners than anyone else in the league this season, and that's where most of their goals come from. And when they do get it to their front men, they've not really got a cutting edge because they're not very good front men. That's why I thought that they will go down this season, particularly after their owner said that they weren't going to be spending any money in January. They may have reviewed that policy now, and I know they are trying to bring in a striker. They've been linked with Robbie Keane and a couple of others, and it's desperately needed.
All right. Sunderland, meantime, have their opportunity to get revenge on Newcastle for that 5-1 they got handed at St James's.
Before they won the last time at the Stadium of Light, they'd lost 7 and drawn 5 at home against Newcastle. And I think they hadn't won since sort of 1980 or 81. Mm. So, but I would expect them, with the team they've got, with Andy Carroll out, I think Sunderland should be warm favourites.
Interesting, with the Birmingham derby, or the West Midlands derby being a relegation battle, these two both in the top half and battling for Europa League places.
Yeah, I'd be really interested to see how Newcastle play, because I was at their match against Stevenage last weekend, and I was quite shocked by how often they resorted to the long ball right from the start. Pardew denied after it, and Andy Carroll wasn't even playing. They were aiming at launching it up towards Leon Best, who couldn't do anything with it. And it's generally not the way Pardew teams have played in the past, and he said afterwards that wasn't what he'd ordered them to do. But I have my doubts, because right from the first minute they did it as if playing to a plan. And I just wonder if, because he's still under a lot of pressure up there, if he sort of, as many managers do, including Roy Hodgson seemed to do at Liverpool, very much against what he'd done at Fulham, is take the sort of back-to-basics approach and launch it into the mixer. Mm. It won't last terribly long at St James's Park if that continues.
It's a bit dangerous for a new manager to say the players didn't do what I asked them to do, isn't it? And we lost.
He blamed it on fatigue after the Christmas programme. And of course, the Stevenage manager pointed out that they'd been quite busy over Christmas too.
Yeah, indeed. And well, finally, and what a big game this is, Spurs taking on Man United. Now, Spurs have a rotten record, of course, against United. I think they've lost 12 of the last 14.
18 of the last 23.
Wow, that's even better.
And then the last time they won, I think, was in May 2001, where William Causton scored twice in a 3-1 win.
Spurs, of course, were beaten last time out at Everton, but they do have Jonas Kabul and Jermaine Defoe coming back. Do you anticipate that making a big difference?
This is a kind of game where Spurs should be trying to make a statement. Hmm. They've won away at Arsenal, so they've beaten their away at the Big Four hoodoo. But you know, Spurs are a good side. They've played some wonderful football. They've got an excellent home record. You know, they've won 4 and drawn 2 of the last 6 at home. They haven't, United have looked flaky without actually crumbling away from home. And Spurs, if they really go at them, I think Spurs are a reasonable you know, a reasonable chance of winning.
With United, you keep feeling that they're not playing that well, they do look flaky, and this unbeaten run is going to come to an end, and it just never does, and they still haven't lost a game. And so are they going to just keep going and have an extraordinary, by the end, look like they've had an extraordinary season, or are the wheels going to come off in one game and finally they're going to kind of get that defeat that everybody thinks that they've been deserving all season?
United, they remind me, to the extent that I understand these things, of the England bowlers in the Ashes, where they just consistently put the ball in the right area and almost wait for the opposition, almost tempt them into a mistake. And Spurs, of course, in the past have always fallen for it because they've been mentally frail. However, this season, they've shown a lot more resolve, despite the wretched injury problems they've had at the back. And they've actually got more points from losing positions than any other team in the league, which is very un-Tottenham-like. And I'm going to predict their victory for Spurs.
Really?
This season. What the hell?
The unbeaten run ends here. Anyone else willing to come out on this one?
Well, I've stuck some money on Spurs at 2-1.
Woof.
As well.
John Ashton?
I think it'll be a draw, because I think there's something strange about this United team that'll take them through. And if they don't, as sort of David was saying, if they don't lose the unbeaten record this weekend, when will they lose it?
Yeah. When indeed?
I'm not going to. You know, why should I not say that Spurs are going to win? And especially because I'm not going to put any money on it.
Indeed.
So I will say that I do think Spurs are going to win.
All right then. Excellent.
What about you, Jim? Are you the man with the predictions? Now and again, about twice a season.
Yeah, but I'm not feeling it. Not feeling it.
So what do you get? Something like sort of stirring in your waters, do you?
Exactly. That's what happens. If anything develops water-wise, I'll let you know.
You're
Sean.
Like some else kind
I'll
of mystic.
Tweet it.
Then we could all put our hands on the table and it'll start levitating.
It would do. So let's avoid all of that. Especially because it's the end of the pod. There's no time for levitating now. Many thanks to Sean, to John, to Paul and to David, and to special guest producer Andy, and you there at home for listening, or wherever indeed you've enjoyed this podcast. We'll be back on Monday rounding up what looks like a pretty significant weekend in the Premier League and elsewhere. Have a super time in the meanwhile. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.